And as I warned you at the outset, we now come back to the woes of the world and the worst outbreak of the Ebola virus, from which such a huge proportion of people who are infected die, has hit West Africa. And the wider world is now in a sort of slow-motion panic as they contemplate the possibility of a pandemic. And I must say, some of the media stuff has been wildly irresponsible. Let's try and avoid those mistakes. My next guest is epidemiologist Dr. Kamalina Lukuge, and she's recently returned from one of the worst-hit countries in Guinea. Now, prior to this, she was in the midst of the big outbreak in Uganda during 2007, a time when most of the staff in the hospitals had either died or run away from fear of contracting the disease. Kamalini's an ANU fellow, a medical epidemiologist for Medecins Sans Frontières, and she joins me from the Northbourne studio. And let me make the point that in 2010, she was awarded the Medal of the Order of Australia for her service to humanitarian aid. Welcome to our little wireless program.
Good evening, Philip.
More than 600 dead in West Africa. Will it become a global pandemic?
I think the question to ask is, do we know what to do to control it? And the good thing is that we do. This Ebola outbreak is caused by the same disease that we've dealt with in Ebola outbreaks in the past, and we know what needs to be done. The difference this time is the scale of the outbreak. Since Ebola was first recognised in 1976, there's been around 2,000 cases over the different outbreaks. Now, this current outbreak in West Africa, we to date have had about 1,700 people infected. So you can see that the difference is the magnitude. It's now in several countries, as you mentioned. It's in different places in each of those countries. And what we need is a massive scale-up of response so we can get the interventions, the personnel, the control measures we know work to each of those places where there's currently infections happening.
Before we push on to the story, I want to look back. Do we know from where it came? I remember when the AIDS issue was beginning, there were stories, all sorts of stories, conspiracy stories, and also arguments that it had been lurking in the jungles of Africa just waiting for a chance to emerge. What do we know about Ebola?
What we do know now is that the reservoir for the virus is certain types of fruit bats. So when we say reservoir, we mean animals who can carry the virus but don't get sick, and so therefore carry it and able to transmit it. It's similar to the way Hendra virus is transmitted. People would be aware of Hendra. It's a virus that was discovered in Queensland some years ago. That too lives in bats, and we get infections when those bats have contact with other animal species. In the case of Ebola, usually you get the initial infections when humans or other animals have contact with bats. But you get this large increase in cases of people getting infected when you have transmission happening in settings where people are being nursed when they're sick by health staff or family members who don't have equipment to nurse them safely, or during burials where families, again, communities bury those that have died of Ebola without proper protection. So the initial introduction into human populations is probably through direct contact with bats, or contact through an intermediate host. For example, a monkey that's been infected by a bat and got sick. But then spread is through those particularly sick people and those who've died.
I remember the world breathing a sort of a sigh of relief in the face of AIDS when it was realised that it couldn't be transmitted by mosquitoes. Now, a second American aid worker this week was diagnosed with Ebola, mm-hmm. flown to a hospital in Atlanta. We've been watching images on the telly, of course. How difficult is it for aid workers like yourself to protect yourself against the disease, which can kill up to 90% of those infected?
I think, again, as I said, we know exactly what needs to be done. Using protective equipment is not complex, in that there's very clear guidelines and procedures.
But there's not a lot of that around in Guinea, Nigeria and Liberia, is there?
Yes, that's exactly the problem. When I have worked in outbreaks, I've worked always with Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, and we always have access to that equipment. And one of the issues now is ensuring that everyone who needs to deal with cases has access to protective equipment, because most of that equipment is disposed of each time you use it. If you're running a centre, you'll have several shifts of staff. Each time those staff go into the treatment centres, see patients, that equipment needs to be disposed of, and the next shift that goes in needs new equipment. Now, you can imagine if that's now those needs are multiplied by the fact that you need treatment centres in many, many areas. You then need teams that are going out, visiting families that have sick people, assisting families who have had someone die. You can see the number of people and the amount of resources that are needed. But as I said, again, we know what we need to do. It's just at the moment a huge scale-up is needed in response.
It is our privilege to be talking to Dr. Kamalini Lukugeng, who's an ANU fellow and a medical epidemiologist for that remarkable organisation, MSF. Now, there are other problems, however, other than the ones you're outlining, mm-hmm. because the outbreaks have been taking place in countries with profoundly traditional views, mm-hmm. where families will refuse to admit that the disease has even affected them. Mm-hmm. I suppose that's another huge problem, isn't it?
That is. But again, you know, I actually remember the early days of HIV. I'd just graduated. And in Australia, there was similar fear, stigma. And I was in Guinea during this outbreak, and part of my job as epidemiologist was to visit the families of patients who had become sick, had died, talk to them about how the infection might have come to the family and who it might have been passed on to. And I remember the first family I visited when we first arrived, they were very angry. They were suspicious, and understandably so. Many teams had been there. The community had become aware that this was a house that maybe had Ebola. They didn't understand what was happening. And I sat with this family, with our team, a very good anthropologist and another surveillance officer, a local person, and we talked to them. We answered their questions for a long time. We explained who we were, that we weren't here in the country to make money. We were there any other reason. We were there to try and help them respond to the outbreak. We answered their questions, and that afternoon the head of the family brought two young men who had been sick in the house with fever. They turned out to have Ebola. They had been hiding them for several days, but they brought them that afternoon, and the next morning he brought another two family members. So again, it's not mysterious. These are places where people have not had access sometimes to any level of functioning health system. They don't have a great deal of trust in the authorities because they haven't delivered for them. So building trust
sometimes,
is important.
Sometimes we've been doing a few stories recently on the hostility to vaccination programs in parts of Africa, where Muslim community leaders, tell the community that that this is a part of a plot. And it turns out that in at least one case involving the CIA, that was true. So, and of course, in your case, or in the case of Ebola, nobody in any culture relishes having their ailing loved ones removed from a family's care, do they? Or their bodies hauled off for ignominious mass graves.
Well, exactly. And when you have a disease that kills so many who are infected with it, then, you know, people look at what is happening and they see allowing those you love to be taken to the treatment centre probably means they won't come back. So part of building that trust is to get people who have recovered and been discharged from the treatment centres to speak to the community, to talk about what has happened. Another part of it is to allow as much access as possible for family to those in the treatment centre by giving them phones. In the MSF treatment centres, a psychologist sits on one side of the fence and patients who are well enough sit some distance away on the other side. So there's no barriers such as protective equipment, masks, and they can safely talk about how they feel. In cases where it's appropriate and family members do want, we can give them some level of protection so they can go in and visit those who are sick. So all of that takes away some of the mystery of what is happening in those treatment centres. When teams go out to assist with a burial, they go without all that equipment, not dressed up in those suits. They go and, maintaining a safe distance, they speak to the family, explain to them what's happening, and then in front of the family, they wear their protective equipment and then start assisting with the burial. So again, I think anyone, if they imagine themselves in that situation, understanding a disease that has killed many, potentially you're worried you too are infected. If you've not been given the information to then participate and understand what is happening in terms of control, I think the reactions that communities have, hiding or running away, is very understandable.
It's not simply in Africa where fear, superstition become a major issue. Think of the problems in this country and in the United States, yes, where people are now refusing to vaccinate their children. They've got no excuse. You know, all the information is available, but they tend to cherry pick nonsense off the internet, yes, and become a danger to everyone. We can't just point to Africa and say, you know, ignorant people. The whole world is capable of the same sort of profound stupidity.
Yes, I think we're all capable, but I think we're all capable of the most profound courage. I always think of this young woman I met during my first Ebola outbreak, actually. When MSF arrived in that town, most of the health staff in the main hospital had either died or run away, and one of the two remaining was this 17-year-old nurse, Khadija, who had just actually finished her nursing training, and she had stayed on, you know, without access to any protective equipment, nursing her colleagues, nursing other patients, and when MSF came, she was there. She worked with MSF throughout the outbreak, so for several months she worked in our treatment centres, and I asked her once, because I imagined when I was 17, I was incapable of anything, let alone that level of courage and commitment. And she said she felt it was important to stay because she knew help would come and that there was someone from her community doing this work. And, you know, she was dealing with her family who were saying, you know, why are you doing this? You are bringing this disease to our home as well. So, you know, there are international staff, and we work alongside many, many staff like Khadija.
I've got to ask you this. Does her story have a comparatively happy ending? Did she survive?
Oh, yes, yes. The day MSF left, we left our compound at 5 in the morning, and Khadija was at the gate to say goodbye and say thank you for coming to help. And I think that's one of the reasons I go, because I imagine, you know, and I think, again, in this outbreak, there's probably many health staff like her responding without the resources or enough resources. And
but you're talking, with all due modesty, you're talking about yourself, Kamalini. Tell me about a day of the life of you at a clinic in Guinea.
So in Guinea, I was working as an epidemiologist, and that job is, as I said, it's to visit patients, talk to those in the treatment centre and try and understand how they got the infection and who they might have passed it to, and then visit family members, health staff in hospitals that might have treated them, and try and understand if that disease may have been transmitted. Ebola, if you've had contact with someone or the body fluids of someone who is sick with the disease, you can develop the disease for up to 21 days after that contact. So anyone who has had contact with someone who's sick or someone who has died of the disease needs to be followed up for 21 days. And and if they then become sick during that time, they need to be taken to a treatment centre. And so you can imagine the huge resources we need to control. So all those families who had someone who had died, all those health staff who had come into contact with someone who had Ebola had to be followed up for 21 days. They have to be, again, as I said, they need to understand the disease. And communities, families are the same as health staff. I visited health centres and the staff were scared, and for them, having information, having someone to talk to who had had experience with the disease before was very empowering. They'd ask me questions about, you know, what should we do when what happens if we get sick. Then you see that once people have that information, they feel again that they're able to take some control back. So again, that was my job.
Yeah. Well, I know you've said this elsewhere, and I want to quote it because it's such an overpowering statement. Perhaps the most heartbreaking aspect of the disease is the fact that families cannot hug their loved ones in their dying hours. I was talking about irresponsible media response, and we're seeing some extraordinary cases in US media at the moment where many people are complaining that anyone is being brought into the United States for treatment. Mm-hmm. Now, what will happen? I mean, you cannot quarantine a world where every second person jumps on a jet plane. Mm-hmm. What will happen when the first case arrives in Australia? What are our preparations?
Well, I was I did an interview with the Chief Health Officer of Australia a few days ago, and he said the risk of that happening is very low. But if it does happen, the risk of Ebola spreading in Australia is low. I mean, it's negligible, and that's because we have such a strong public health system. We have such a strong clinical health services, and also because, as I said, Ebola is not like the flu. It's not transmitted by sitting next to someone on a bus or someone sneezing. You need to have very close contact with the body fluids of someone who's very sick with the disease. So you would know if you had exposure to someone who was likely to have been transmitting Ebola. So even in the extremely unlikely event that someone was able to come to Australia, we would be able to respond to stop the outbreak spreading. But I think it's important more to focus on how do we prevent that happening, and the best investment Australia can make in preventing Ebola coming to Australia is to support the response in the countries that are currently affected by it.
And to be very generous with MSF, I would suggest as well. That would be a damn good thing to do. Now, tell me this. We're talking about a disease which was first discovered in, what, 1976.
Yes.
Would you remind me of that first case?
So the name comes from that, Ebola would have existed for, but it was first recognised during that outbreak, which occurred simultaneously in Zaire and in Sudan. But the outbreak happened, or most cases were seen, in a hospital on the Ebola River. So that's how it got that name. And, you know, again, as well as the high mortality with Ebola, the other thing that causes such fear is that there's no specific vaccine or specific cure treatment for it. We, in the treatment centres, people get supportive treatment, and that does reduce mortality. But because of these factors, and also the fact that health staff become sick if they haven't had appropriate protection, there's a lot of fear around the disease. But compared to that first outbreak, we have a lot more knowledge about the transmission and how to control the disease now.
Well, we saw a very interesting and quite encouraging response, finally, to HIV/AIDS. Mm-hmm. And little by little, the world learnt, or had the potential to deal with it, the scientific capacity. Mm-hmm. I'm told that Big Pharma is not terribly interested in Ebola because it affects, thus far, so few people. There's not much money in it. Do you know, Camerlini, whether there are major research projects going on to tackle it as HIV was tackled?
So I'm not an expert in this area. I'm not a virologist, but I understand there are some vaccines that are under development but not ready for use yet. And I think it's similar with many diseases, as you say, that affect those without a lot of material wealth. But I was listening to your previous guest, and what he said was so so appropriate, I thought. He said, you forget about the them and it all becomes us.
Absolutely.
We're all in
Absolutely.
It together.
Yeah.
And that's one thing that infectious diseases really demonstrate, that there is no fortress, or no, the best investment we can make to protect ourselves is to support the health systems, to support response, to support adequate healthcare, safe working conditions for health workers in the many countries that aren't as lucky as Australia.
Well, I know you've written that if a hospital has good infection control, even basic things like running water, if they have gloves, if they have proper waste disposal, you probably won't get big outbreaks.
Yeah, no, it's as I said, we see amplification around sick people around funerals. And if you have hospitals that can respond, and again, I say it again, it's not a disease that's terribly contagious. If you have those basic things, running water, soap, mask, gloves, health staff, you know, first line responders in the setting where the outbreak hasn't yet been discovered, there's much less chance of large numbers of health staff or patients getting infected.
You heard Chris Hadfield talking about the way he was changed by his experience circumnavigating the planet a few squillion times. How has your contact with these diseases changed you?
I think one of the things is that I grew up in Canberra, and as you said, people are the same everywhere, but I think you only see how incredible people are when they're challenged. And I think when you work in outbreaks like this, you see the most incredible courage and commitment from people you work alongside, and that always gives you hope, I think. Yeah, I wouldn't keep doing these things if I didn't feel that there were people with me and beside me, and that's always the case. It's in the worst times that you see the best in people.
Absolutely. Now, you told us about Khadija. That's a beautiful story. But I find it astonishing that there are so many people involved in MSF who give up lucrative careers and spend so much time, you know, at the cutting edge of this of these catastrophes. Mm-hmm. Does MSF look after its own? I'm not talking about, you know, health procedures so much as mental health. Are there therapists, are there psychologists, people who help MSF people deal with these issues?
Yes, we have psychologists in the field for the staff. We have psychologists when we come back. For me personally, the hardest time is when I come home. When you're in the field, you know exactly what you need to do. You're with colleagues who understand, who you're all in it together. But you come home and you're away from that. You're back in your own community. Often people don't really know what the disease is. And so MSF has psychologists too who help you when you come back. I first worked for MSF in 96 in Afghanistan, and I've worked for a lot of different organisations on and off, but I keep coming back to MSF. They don't pay very well, but apart from that, they are the best.
Yeah, and of course they've been an inspiration. There are so many other versions of MSF, not necessarily in medicine. For example, one of my friends runs an outfit called Architects Without Frontiers, who go into troubled areas and rebuild, you know, villages destroyed by earthquakes. This whole idea of breaking down the barriers of nationalism and maps, and having the view of our world that Chris Hadfield had.
Yeah, I think it was wonderful to hear that before I came on, to hear someone with a totally different experience but coming to that same conclusion, that it's us, not them.
Camelina, it's great to talk to you. It's been an honour. Camelina Lukuge is a medical epidemiologist for the wonderful MSF, and tomorrow we'll be looking at fertility and gender in Nigeria and how you might go about surviving Bosnia's peace. So I'll talk to you again in 23 hours after a program which I found quite remarkable.